Well, good morning and welcome to the Biz News Briefing. I'm Alec Hogg. We'll be with you for about the next half hour. We're going to be talking today about some shocks coming through from Wall Street. ASML, that is a stock that is in the Biz News portfolio. ASML is one of the holdings there. It took an awful knock on Wall Street last night, down by 16%. We'll find out exactly why. Also today, a mining focus with Bernard Swanepoel, our studio guest, and we'll be hearing from the banking sector with Corky Koyman. But it's a warm welcome to Bernard Swanepoel. Well, Bernard, very good to have you here on this inaugural episode of the Biz News Briefing going live streaming. My goodness, it's amazing what technology can do for us nowadays.
Good morning, Alec, and to all your listeners.
And for those who don't know you or forgotten you, you were the CEO of Harmony Gold, and you're a private entrepreneur now, and best known in the public arena for hosting the Joburg Mining Indaba. And that's why I wanted to pick up with you today. Earlier this month, you got people from all over the world to attend. And I sensed in the reports that you put out that it's looking a little more positive.
Alec, I think it probably sums up where many people in South Africa are, cautious optimism. I don't think this is Ramaphosa 2, you know, this sort of like exuberant optimism founded on hope. I think we are living in a world, which a South Africa, which is reset politically. I think our politicians took lovely snot claps at the polls. Everybody got told what you do is not what we, the voters, want. And I think there's a sort of hopefully a political sort of alignment towards economic growth. And you can add the words inclusive and job creation. And I mean, those are the things that obviously plays perfectly into the mining space. Mining as a foundational part of the economy, especially in South Africa, can thrive when politicians let us be and allow us to do responsible extraction of the mineral endowment of the country. And I think it's that bringing those politicians and then, of course, the CEOs of the mining industry together, which resulted in a very, very constructive, but as always, blunt and forthright conversation.
I wouldn't expect anything different from you. But you did have Gwede Mantashe there. He's been a disappointing figure for the mining industry for quite some time. Are you seeing, given that he's very important in the government of national unity, any improvement in the mood towards him?
You know, the mining industry have had this interesting bromance with Minister Mantashe, almost disproportionately to the relationship with his department. It is indeed so that Gwede Mantashe was there. I think he actually was there on the gala dinner and day one and day two. And most importantly, what we get right is that his department also attends. So we're not talking about them, we're talking to them. And that makes a significant difference. So I think at all times there would have been senior representatives of the department in the room. We also, for the first time, engaged with the DTIC, the Department of Trade and Industry and Competition, because obviously policy making is not happening in the mining department per se. It is the policy, the economic policy of the country, which has been stifling economic growth. And I think it's actually quite good that there was a generational change in some departments. I think politically we all would have wanted more change in terms of political leadership. But the environment in which we can engage with what will it take to make South Africa a mining destination? Yes, it's the obvious things like the so-called cadastre system and better environment for exploration. But it is also about how the Competition Commission interferes in transactions way beyond the law. It's also about how the country doesn't incentivize reindustrialization that is required for for the critical minerals of the future. So it's much broader conversations. Having your minister in the room is useful and good, regardless of whether you like him or don't like him.
Well, I'm going to take you now to Lichtenburg, and one of the people who's often with you at the Joburg Mining Indaba is Andries van Heerden from Afrimat. And I spoke yesterday to Derek Matthews, who's the chairman of Grain SA and on the board of Agri SA. And as often happens in these interviews, you get a bit of a surprise towards the end. And I asked him a little bit about what's going on in Lichtenburg in the light of what Afrimat is doing with its cement factory there. And here's what he had to say.
The Lichtenburg plant. So yeah, I do understand the, you know, it was White's first, White's Portland Cement, then it became Blue Circle, Hubert Davies, and then eventually Lafarge, and now the new, I saw the new name going up on the board just recently. Afrimat, yeah. Industry in town is critically important. I mean, Lichtenburg is an agricultural town. Lichtenburg, of course, is famous for the biggest diamond rush in the world. There was massive diamond deposits just to the northwest of Lichtenburg. Then, of course, agriculturally, the first agricultural co-op was based in Lichtenburg. So the town has a mix of cement and grain farming, or mixed farming, really. I don't know if you know that over and above Afrimat now, there's also Afrisam, which is the second cement plant. And then there's also a third one went up about 2 years ago called Sapaka. So there are three big cement manufacturers in the area, but that's simply because there's very rich limestone deposits, and it makes sense for them to make the cement here. You know, if they're energized to turn our town around, what a wonderful thing that would be. I mean, the town is suffering. We used to have a beautiful town, an efficiently run town. The streets are in total disrepair. There's inconsistent water supply, inconsistent electricity. I don't think the municipality has functioned in the last 5 years. On the road out to my farm, you actually drive through the rubbish dump. I was driving into town one morning and somebody was actually literally dumping a truckload of rubbish on the main road in the street. I mean, the citizens are just as much to blame. You shouldn't be doing that. But there's just no management. There's just absolutely no management. And if we don't, as citizens in town, get up, repair the water infrastructure, repair the electricity and all that stuff, it just doesn't happen. So if we can get some fresh energy from a new owner of the cement business, that would be fantastic. It would be great for the town.
Well, there we go. There's some fresh energy going into the heart of the cement industry. I suppose, Bernard, the big question for Lichtenburg, given all the cement plants that are there, is that if South Africa does become a construction site, this will be a booming little town.
Oh, it could certainly be. It probably already is. But, I mean, you can go to the east and Lim. You can go to all those towns there in the Steelpoort area. I recently went there for the first time, probably in 10 years, and you feel like you need to look at a map and see where you are, how the place has sort of boomed. And obviously with mining, and I mean lime mining would be part of that, you get your basic infrastructure. You get your roads. The mines need infrastructure, so you get electricity. And typically nowadays, the mines are active citizens in terms of local government. The political governance of our towns is a shocker throughout the country, everywhere. But in order to at least get some of the basic utilities working, mines play a big role. Probably right back as into 50 and 60 years ago, the mining industry I grew up in, the mines were very involved in the local towns. We are right back there out of necessity. So I think if you have mining, responsible mining, near in a town near you, you're a fortunate South African citizen. We all know about the disgraceful mining, illegal mining, chrome theft. I mean, let's not pretend that everything is fine, but the organized, structured mining of South Africa is a fantastic corporate citizen, and especially at these times where everything else seems to be dying of neglect.
That's a perfect segue for another clip from an interview I had yesterday that I'd love you to listen to. Paul Kernahan is the Chief Wealth Officer at Fed Group. And this was a sponsored interview, and it's quite funny. Sometimes you, in the sponsored interviews, you get some really good little gems that come out. And Paul started talking about public-private partnerships and how he sees them as a growing area and something that into the future we could be seeing a heck of a lot more in South Africa. Love to get your insights, Bernard.
There's no secret that our public sector government coffers are empty. You know, there's not much more room to move. That fiscal constraint is a real thing. So even more so, there's this call on public-private partnerships. And a lot of people in the market think that these things haven't happened. There's an excess of 70 billion rands worth of successful, completed public-private partnerships that exist in South Africa to this date, in tourism, water and sanitation, infrastructure, you name it. There's been some incredible success stories, and you're seeing already now, because of that fact that you've got this base, you've got policies that support giving these private companies comfort, you're starting to see this investment from South African companies into our own very domestic economy, because there's this bridge saying, okay, if I'm going to take my skill and my money into these public partnerships now, I know that the policy supports it now. There's an agreement. That national development plan, it required by 2030 to move up to 30% of GDP needs to be allocated to infrastructure projects. So we have to do it. If you're a proudly South African company, it's more around whether you want to or not. Now you've got to do it. We've got to get stuck in, and we're seeing it happen as well, which is just fantastic. And it's not just lip service. Obviously, we rub shoulders with the leaders of the leading private companies and in South Africa, and they are starting to really invest deeply, which is wonderful. And you know, there's no secrets. You know, the forward multiples and the PEs of our SA companies are sitting even lower than the average forward multiples of emerging markets. You're talking half of the multiples of the US. The nice thing about it is that we've got all these good things that we're talking about, but also this all this upside. It's like a kid that's got all this potential but hasn't quite reached the right level to play for the Springboks. And that's maybe a wonderful analogy, and maybe it's a bit of a well-used analogy, but if you look at our Springboks, you know, the process that Rusty took them through, I think that's where our GNU is, but he got a bunch of highly diverse players, highly skilled players, and half the work he had to engage in was getting them to work together from massively varied backgrounds. It's almost where our GNU is now. We sort of, but look what can happen if you get it right. So I foresee that in the next few years, we're going to see as much success as the Boks have had. And it sounds a bit loose and frivolous, but it's fact. This is where business is made. Business is made in getting on with each other, relationships, seeing eye to eye and trusting each other.
You know, I really like these guys at Fed Group. I spent a bit of time with them in Joburg, Bernard, and they think differently. They've been around for 30 years or so. They go into alternative investments, impact agriculture, very big in property. So it's all a long-term kind of game. But I like what he's saying on, well, I mean, I love the analogy, I'm sure you do, about the Springboks and South Africa's, you know, the rest of the economy could just be going there.
Yeah, let's celebrate what happened a year ago, and then 3 weekends in a row, we all got crazy because the Springboks were always going to win, but why did they have to wait for the last minute was one point. And I think this partnership model that is being formed under fire in South Africa is going to be critical if we make this work. The GNU is a political one. But, you know, it's 2 years ago at the Joburg Indaba, where the blowout with Porsche Derby, that time the Transnet CEO, took place. The industry demanded that she be fired, resignation. Out of that came processes still led by Pravin Gordhan to start off collaboration. Last year we had a follow-up conversation. This year we had Transnet's CEO, Eskom CEO, we had a panel discussing how this collaboration is clearly already delivering results at Eskom. Transnet, it's still in the sort of cautiously optimistic, let's hope things come better. But when you bring both capital, but also the leadership and the ability to direct resources of the private sector, there's no problem that South Africans can't solve. I mean, operating a railway line between two points, we've done that for 100 years in the country. Of course we can do it. We must just focus on doing the basics right. And so personally, one of the highlights of the last 2 or 3 years of conversations, like we are having at a Joburg and Durban, is exactly seeing the emergence of this PPPs, so-called PPPs. And of course, it's a fantastic success story now, and success has many fathers. Our own contribution was but to highlight these conversations, have the same people on a platform, let them speak to all of us as South Africans, and it makes for fantastic conversation. But I really think some key parts of our economy is being refurbished, re-oiled, perhaps just the rust has been taken off. But I'm quite optimistic about this part of our economic engine.
Are you in the same kind of mood that Paul Kernahan is? You did say earlier it's not another Ramaphosa, and that's a relief. But on the other hand, that we could replicate what Rassie's done with the Springboks, or we, Cyril, with all those people around him in the government of national unity, as Paul was saying, he's got diverse talents, but they all, certainly the new guys, seem to be doing terribly well.
No, absolutely. And I mean, quite honestly, it is up to him. You know, he is the coach and the manager. I mean, he is the key person. And I think it is hopefully a moment in time which he has been raised for his whole life. I mean, perhaps this is the moment. This fits his style better by all accounts. And I do think the one thing we should just start to credit, I think, everybody in the team is, I mean, I think everybody wants the country to win. We come from different perspectives. We define win differently sometimes. But I think narrowing it down to a few key areas which we can all align with, from big business to the right wing, the left wing, the middle wing. I mean, I think making it clear what is critically important to our economy makes it easier. We have defined what winning will look like for us through our economy in the next few years. I personally have always had a high respect for President Ramaphosa. He's a miner by background. We trained him well, and so he's got the abilities. And I think this is the moment where he may just be the correct guy. But like with the Springboks, we've got no choice. This is our team. We are playing for this team. We are part of this team. We have to support this team. Of course, we can be critical. I still sometimes shout at Willie LaRue. I mean, he's the best player in the world. Apparently, he's the best player in the world. I shot at him and I can't even play rugby. So that is what we do as fans. But we're also supportive, and we also, you know, wear the colors, and we, you know, we contribute. And so I think this is truly where South Africa can be. And I mean, the overused rugby analogy is applicable. I mean, yes, we're a diverse country. And the more diversity we bring, the more skills we bring, the new skills we bring. Yeah, Alec, but I must tell you, I mean, growing up, the leadership that grew up in the last 20 years in our country are going to be phenomenal. Can you imagine growing up in this complex world of dysfunctionality being South Africa Inc.? I mean, the 40-year young leaders now taking over mining companies, I've never seen people like that. They are phenomenal. They are Etzebets and Colbys and pick your name. I mean, these are phenomenal leaders that have been trained up, not because we were smart and we did it deliberately, just in order for business and mining in South Africa to survive. Phenomenal people. And Andries van Heerden is but one of them. I mean, there are lots of these people run companies in ways that is, I mean, we've raised world beaters in mining, and I'm sure in our economy overall.
I can just hear our tribe saying, ask him. Give me some examples.
Of these young, phenomenal people. But listen, I mean, some of these are still the big brand names. But I mean, just think, I mean, if you sit with Duncan Oneblood and you talk about his vision for Anglo-American, I think Anglo-American is going to be the world's premier, one of the world's premier copper players And out of that came lots of things, intentional and unintentional. But the spinning back out of the assets into South Africa, once we all over all the emotional stuff, can you imagine if Anglo Platinum is being run independently in the interest of the platinum industry, its shareholders, and South Africa? It's going to be a catalyst that's going to change, you know, significantly South Africa Inc. and the mining industry. You go to the other extreme and you look at these guys in the Northern Cape reopening old copper mines. Now, I mean, you know my own background. I love old mines. Other people have spent the capital. You come and you make some nice money for your shareholder. But, I mean, if you go to those mines and you look at what is happening there, and, I mean, these are people who don't long back to the good old days. They never lived the good old days. This is a generation of leaders that only know this complicated environment, and they have not only survived, but they've sort of thrived. So quite honestly, I want to honestly tell you there will always be mining cycles. And, you know, when the coal price is up, you can buy anything coal. If you don't gold shares, you've obviously missed the biggest cycle in the history of cyclical sort of industries. But underpinning it, the opportunities when you bring good ore bodies like South Africa have with world-class leaders that we have grown out of necessity, it's very hard to be overly pessimistic. But, of course, I'm not talking about the quarterly time horizon of a fund manager. I'm talking about the generational horizon that our political leaders and some of our business leaders should have.
I'm so pleased to have had Bernard Swanepoel with us this morning. Thank you, Bernard. We look forward to having your wisdom, or sharing your wisdom with us in future as well. Bernard Swanepoel is the host of the Joburg Mining Indaba and an entrepreneur in the mining sector, well, for more decades, I guess, than he would care to admit to. We will be talking in just a moment to Kokkie Kooiman, but before then, I'm going to bring you up to date with what's been going on around the world. And my word, on Wall Street last night, there was a shudder. You might recall that on Monday night, Wall Street hit an all-time high with the stocks surging. And last night, ASML Holdings led the way down. Here's our partners at the Financial Times of London giving the outline to exactly what came with the quarterly results, which incidentally were released a day early. So they didn't even have time to prepare the market, hence a 16% drop in the share price.
Dutch chipmaker ASML gave a pretty gloomy outlook yesterday on demand for semiconductors. The company said its orders were only half of what investors had expected last quarter, and it also cut its outlook for next year. Two of the companies it supplies are facing their own issues. Intel reported disappointing results in August, and Samsung said it was falling behind on AI chip making. ASML's stock plunged more than 16% yesterday. And the investor jitters didn't stop there. Shares in U.S. chip makers NVIDIA and AMD fell more than 4.5%.
So it was contagion across the board, a pretty important issue. And we picked up from our partners at Bloomberg this morning, Daybreak Asia, which is their program that, in fact, is still on air, I think, spoke with Olivia D'Assia, who's head of investment decision research at SimCorp, about ASML. I'm giving it a lot of airtime because ASML Holdings is one of the biggest stocks in the BizNews portfolio.
I think it's, you know, mostly a wake-up call to reality, right? We've been saying AI could do all these things, but it actually can't. So it can't drive a car by itself yet. It's still got a long way to learn before it can be applied to other things than just, you know, chatbots and purely technology or internet kind of industries. And I think that's where a lot of that is coming now, and people have rushed to buy these chips because they were afraid of shortage and not really having tested the applications yet or anything yet. And now they're discovering that, okay, it's going to take us a little bit longer, a little bit more testing, a little bit more engineering to figure out how to really use this in the manufacturing of a car or manufacturing of a toaster or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what we're seeing. But and at the same time, analysts or investors had really outsized expectations for that sector, for earnings, for sales and everything, like just thinking it would go on like that forever. So I think it's a little bit of a reality check, but not any kind of red flags yet for global economy or global tech sector.
The other part of the story here is the fact that a lot of the equipment manufactured by ASML to actually produce semiconductors in cases of more advanced chips, I mean, this equipment is restricted. Let's not forget that, right? So, I mean, if you're the company, might we not hear in the days ahead, hey, if you loosen some of the restrictions, maybe our performance would be better?
It could, but I think that's an excuse that no one would really use. Restrictions have been in place for a long time, but there are so many loopholes around these things that everybody who needs one can get one. So they don't really work in terms of sanctions.
And another mitigating factor in this might be that a company like TSMC, which is, you know, ever important on the global stage, is getting so good in its efficiency, improving its EUV efficiency, that it kind of reduces the need for these specialty machines that ASML is making. So I guess, like what you're saying, is it's a little too early to say that this is a big read here on the global economy, but something worth watching, right?
Yes, that's right. And it's worth watching because it's such a big part of investors' portfolios nowadays, right? So they obviously will have taken a hit from that and will be investing, be upset. But the performance year to date is so good already that it's just really a chip in the armor.
It's pretty important on this because we've seen that the shares of AI companies have been driving Wall Street higher. And indeed, doing well for our portfolio, Palantir, which is, well, we cut it down to 14% of the portfolio. It was down a little bit overnight in Wall Street. In fact, Wall Street overall was more than 1% lower. But it's still sitting at $42 as against the $8.90 that we bought in at. However, Koki Kooiman. Now, there are two issues, Koki. Koki is with Denker Capital. He is the go-to man, has always been. At BizNews and previously for me on anything to do with financial services. But he's also got a Dutch heritage. So if you've got a Dutch heritage, you've got to be watching ASML. Koki, I hope you know a little bit about enough about that company to tell us why it's so relevant, the news that came out yesterday, that they're only delivering half the machines that they expected.
Yeah, Ian Cantor of Investec always used to tell me about this company in Holland that was just mind-boggling. And this is, we're talking 10, 15 years ago already, who was saying, you must buy this. But you're quite right. They are dominant and they are just, have this unique process and setup that allows them to deliver those chips and at very specialized. Nobody can compete with them because of basically it's a monopoly.
And they do, they build the machines that actually create the chips. And I suppose they're selling less machines, as we heard from the Bloomberg guys, well, actually from SimCorp's expert, because people are getting smarter at it and they were worried that there might be a shortage and so on. So really, the message we're getting from Wall Street is don't panic. It is a blip, but it isn't something that's going to affect the long-term potential for ASML because, as you say, it's a bit of a monopoly there. David Shapiro's favorite stock as well, Koki. So I guess that's one of the reasons why we put it in the portfolio. But you've been having a good time of late. You've been telling us for ages that banking shares are cheap, 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 especially international and American banking shares. My goodness, they've been on a run.
Yeah, now I must say, I looked last night, I looked back at the last 12-month price performances, and you know, generally the U.S. banks are all up sort of between 40 to 60% on a 12-month basis, and you still got some dividends as well. And Europe did even better, and partly it's because post-COVID, the whole global cycle in terms of interest rates, in terms of growth, was so different because COVID, obviously, whole economies got shut down and with these huge fears about possible bad debt. So the banking stocks took a huge clap, to put it in Afrikaans. And then interest rates came down. But then after that, everybody was so worried about the bad debts. But then interest rates, because of the inflation, went up so sharply that the European banks made literally a killing. I mean, their margins went from, well, more than doubled. So you could see on every European bank over those 2 years how the return on capital went from, let's say, 8% to 14%, simply by higher interest rates, the wider margins they make on lending at higher rates, and obviously deposit prices didn't react that quickly. Okay, so now we're a few years further down the line. Now finally, inflation seems to have been tamed. There are still obviously, that's how low it will come, but inflation coming down, and our interest rates are starting to come down. And now we're on the other end of the cycle, but now investors got confused because banks did well when interest rates went up. How can they now do well again when interest rates come down? But the key is the bad debts never came through. And that's also post-2008, where the regulators made so many changes, made banks so much safer, forced them to hold more capital, better loan portfolios. So, yeah, Alex, sorry, a lot of background there, but essentially the results that we've seen published so far were generally above expectations, and expectations were fairly good. The comments, importantly, comments were positive about the economy, and the comments were positive about the consumer. So none of the U.S. banks that reported so far said, oh, we see a big problem coming because the U.S. economy is falling into a hole or the consumers are over-leveraged. The only negative comment came from Jamie Dimon, and he's always the bear at these calls, his post-result calls. And he's just warning, he said, global conditions remain treacherous, and they're getting worse. And he's more referring there to, you know, the Middle East situation, the Ukraine, Russia situation, China, Taiwan. So there's a lot of global conditions that are a bit worrying, but on the U.S. economy, fairly good. If you look at the results, then generally loan growth still very poor. Well, poor 1% to 2%. That's quite low. And the loan growth that there was there is by credit card growth. So the credit card businesses of the U.S. banks grew strongly. And the provisions they did make for future bad debts are all more related to potential later when those loans to make now become bad debts. So overall, for the rest, good results. Valuation still not bad. The U.S. banks are not cheap anymore, but compared to, let's say, NVIDIA and those type of things, they're still on P's of between 10 and 12.
Let's come home now. And in South Africa, we've seen the optimism coming from two things, really. The government of national unity, and in today's program, we've had some more support for the optimism there that it might not be another Ramaphosa that fades away, and Eskom delivering electricity. The biggest beneficiaries of an improved South African economy, well, traditionally would be the banks. Are we seeing any of that coming through yet?
Yes, no, definitely. The recent results for the September month and quarter that were published, the banks submit the information to the Reserve Bank and then it gets published, shows that the corporate lending is starting to pick up, specifically interesting overdrafts. So initially corporates, obviously maybe still testing the water, still actually being still uncertain, and initially just using the overdraft facilities rather than in arranging longer term fixed commitments. Consumers still under pressure, we know that. And the consumer obviously will improve as now petrol prices have come down, as interest rates might come down. But in South Africa, you're quite right. The key to our growth rate is government reforms continuing, and then banks starting to participate in the lending on infrastructure. It's actually interesting, all the way back in, was it 1989? David Shapiro and myself were still running sub-3 marathons then, where at Old Mutual I did a huge exercise trying to work out when do banks do well. Because post P.W. Botha's Rubicon speech, capital left the country and the banks were trading at very low valuations. And all the research I did and subsequently showed that your banks generally do best when a country attracts capital. And that makes so much sense, because when you attract capital, there's more liquidity, you can lend more, your interest rates don't go up that much, your currency appreciates. And I think we're in that cycle now again. So if President Ramaphosa continues with what he's doing now and everybody sticks together, we are going to see capital come into the country. I hear it from our CEOs. They're seeing more and more interest of foreign investors. Capital comes in, the rand strengthens further, and then you can start lending and grow. But it's in the hands literally of the politicians at this stage.
The banking index is up 12.5% in the last 3 months. If you take it on a year-on-year basis, it's already 35%. Is it too late to buy South African banks?
No, I don't think so. Well, it's one of those where if it goes wrong, and you could just tomorrow have a few defections from ANC members going across to MK or something like that, or there's an internal split in the ANC. I mean, the outside of left field, well, they're not so outside, but the negative potential things that could happen. But if they don't happen and we continue the path, then our banks could still rate and should still rate quite a bit. Also, simply because they come off a very low basis and loan growth will pick up. And then as loan growth picks up, then APSA is still trading. I think, okay, APSA has got its own problems, but below 1x book. Nedbank is still very cheap. So Capitec, obviously expensive, but it's powering away with what it's doing at the moment. So you could still see easily a further re-rating. And you can see that we're on the average now, I think, of our 20-year price to NAV. In bull conditions that we will get, if this happens, they could rate another 20% higher.
Cookie, you did mention Capitec. Let's close off there. Every time we look at Capitec that we should think about adding it to the portfolio, the business portfolio, we put off because it's just so much more expensive than other banks. We've got FirstRand in the portfolio. Is it time now to just throw caution to the wind and say, come on, these are the winners, let's go with them?
Yeah, it depends on your horizon, Alec. If you have a just 5-year horizon, and a lot of your investors in your type of portfolios would have that. They don't want to necessarily trade the whole time. Then Capitec will continue to win, especially if what they're starting to do with Everfin now in Eastern Europe. That's all very, very beginning stages. Short term, it is expensive. There's no ways that you can get around it, but it's such a phenomenal machine. I've been reading the books now about Stephen Jobs and Elon Musk, and you just see the inventiveness and the drive of those people, and they just continue driving their businesses. You've got the same similar team at Capitec, unbelievable management team who will continue long term growth. So, if I didn't have now, I would add some. But maybe you wait for, there will be some bad news along the way. We know how cycles go, even if it's international, but markets will come down, and maybe just wait for that, but then be ready. So this is the day I buy Capitec when it goes down 10% with the market.
Cookie Kooyman is with Denker Capital. Well, we close off the program with another South African company, and this is best known in this country by its name of Karoo. It's nothing to do with the semi-desert, but it owns a brand called CarTrack. And the financial results were released earlier this week. They are impressive, to say the least. This is an exponentially growing business, but also with high subscription revenue. I asked Magnus Haystack during our conversation yesterday what he thought of Karoo, and indeed its CEO, Zach Callister. I'll give you some more details on what was discussed last night in the US. It is a NASDAQ-listed company as well. It's on the JSE and NASDAQ with their conference call. I think most people left there feeling pretty happy. But let's kick off with what Magnus had to say.
You know, I have been following Zach Callister for a long time, and I, just keep an eye on what he's doing. So, he had to go and get a NASDAQ listing to really impress the world. South Africa, unfortunately, and I've mentioned it in the past, if it comes to the technological innovative companies, our investment community is a little bit more inward looking. They buy nice banks and insurance companies, and they know the retailers very well, and a couple of gold mines in the old days. But the real technological companies, they had to go overseas to the NASDAQ, where there's a totally different environment. They like putting money into those type of companies because that's where you make the really, really big bucks. You know, you look at a company like NVIDIA, which today or very soon could be the biggest company in the world. Now, NVIDIA, a lot of people think, oh, it's a flash in the pan. NVIDIA is 30 years old. It's only in the last 10 years, 10, 12 years, that the share price really took off. And, you know, the share price is just compounded, compounded, compounded. Unfortunately, South African investors have largely missed that boom in the IT, the technological, the AI, the computers. We just never had that culture, whereas that culture is inbred in the United States, and where enormous fortunes have been created by, you know, startup companies, and then they rise through to the top, like NVIDIA and NBC with many, many others as well.
Maybe we're a little reluctant to embrace exponential companies. It's hard to get your head around these businesses that grow 30, 40, 50% a year and then to value them accordingly. And of course, NVIDIA is growing much faster than that even. It's almost a bit of a conservative approach that we take to investing in South Africa. But who knows? Maybe the next Karoo is going to be appreciated here.
You know, you're quite right. I was looking at the five-year numbers for the Signia Fang fund today. It's both a fund and an ETF. And they had to close the fund because they don't have offshore capacity. That has given us a return of the last 5 years of 30% per annum. Now, that is seriously creating a lot of wealth. Yet, I battle to find many analysts and commentators and journalists even to write and talk and discuss it. Whereas in the United States, that will be on the front pages every day. Not only one company, but many, many of those type of companies. Stanlib used to have a technological company or technology company, a listed entity, a unit trust. They closed it down in 2013. When I asked them, why are you closing it down? I want to put some money in. They said, no, the local market is not ready for it. Now, that may be a symptomatic of a kind of short-sightedness on the part of investors. Maybe they don't like the volatility. Maybe we're more conservative than we care to admit. But, you know, if you're stuck with something like the FANG stocks for 5 years and more, you know, 30% growth over time. And again, this year it's up in dollar terms, 53%, rand terms, 40%.
Extraordinary growth that has been achieved. And as you heard earlier from Corky Kooiman, similarly with the big American banks. So I suppose it does give you a bit of nervousness when you have a look at the fighting that's going on between the two new potential presidents and how we could see America going on to a strange trajectory, no matter who wins. But getting back to the owners of CarTrack, that is Karoo. I'd suggest go and have a look. You can Google it and go and read through the transcript of the conference call to investors that Zach Calisto and his team gave yesterday. It's terribly impressive. Year on year for the second quarter, remember this is the 3 months to the end of September, it's their second quarter of their financial year, which goes through until March next year, they had a 15% growth in their subscription revenue to just about R1 billion for the three-month period. Now that's really impressive because subscribers are a far better source of sustainable revenue than the one-off purchases. And we've seen many companies around the world moving towards subscription bases, Microsoft, just one obvious example. And what has served us terribly well in the BizNews portfolios is moving into those stocks as soon as they have moved themselves onto subscription-based revenue streams, what you call the automated customer. Karoo has also started a second business there, which is in the logistics area, where they believe that they can add further value to their clients here in South Africa. It's very much a South African-focused business, but it is growing internationally. But listed in NASDAQ, as Magnus was saying, because the Americans seem to have a far better understanding of companies like these. Well, we hope that we'll be able to share better understandings for the whole BizNews tribe as we go forward. I hope you've enjoyed the first live stream of the BizNews briefing. I'll be back again tomorrow at 7 a.m. Until then, cheerio.